Accession number 27340, Reel 5.
Right, Riggs, Reel 5. Could you tell me where your action station was on board ship?
Yeah, my action station was on gun turret B, right down in the bowels of the ship, as low as we can get. We'd A turret in front, and we were in B turret. Need to go right down, loading shells onto the roundabout, which were then fed from the roundabout into the lift to go up to the guns.
What was it like lifting the shells onto the rack?
Well, we can manage it, you know. They were heavy, no doubt. I've forgotten how much they weighed, to be honest. But they were really heavy. But more often than not, unless they were actually going to... when we were doing what they call working up exercises in Malta, that was before the war was over and before we... On our way, we're working up exercises in Malta. Then we sort of practiced firing at that point, and that's when chiefly we loaded it. Other times, practice action stations, you never really got into the swing of loading it, lifting it up. It was just being there, and it wasn't a pleasant experience the first time, but one thing I particularly remember, we went to action stations, went down, and there were two seamen, and they sang in harmony, and the one thing they always sang was the Hawaiian that one, and they sang it not continuously, but when there's nothing else to talk about. And of course you're limited because you're sort of isolated down there, and there's nobody at all that you're a personal friend. And you chat to people and try to form sort of conversation, which in those circumstances isn't always easy. You know.
Are all the hatches?
Oh, everything's battened down. Yes. As I recall, there are certain when it's full action stations, all doors are locked. There are certain ones that are marked, I think, with a Z, that can be left open but closed in the event of an action station. But the details, I'm sorry, I can't remember. But the waterproof doors in each compartment. And we're all battened down.
So would you have to go to your action station? How would you know to go there? What would be the thing?
They would be piped.
And how easy was it to get from where you were stationed if you'd been in the vigilant office? How easy was it to get down to the shell?
Halfway down the just over halfway down the ship, I was there, and I went down, not on there, but on the same, and go down there.
So you'd have to go really half the length of the ship, really,
yeah,
wouldn't you?
And then climb down the ladder.
Yeah. Okay, so you were. You come out of hospital and the ship had been provisioned,
yeah.
And you were ready to sail for the Far East.
What was the
route that you took?
The route that we took, well, first of all, we went from the Tyne up to Rosyth. And at Rosyth, before we got there, apparently they found a fault in the engine room, which kept us at Rosyth for almost a month.
When had you sailed?
We sailed from the Tyne on the 6th of May 1945 and arrived at Rosyth on the 6th of May, and we stayed at Rosyth from then until we apparently took up to the 11th of June. No, that can't be right. I'm just getting some notes here. No, sorry, we got to Rosyth on the 6th of May, the same day that we left the Tyne. And we left Rosyth on the 11th of June, because there was this fault in the engine room. And when the captain announced it, there was a mumbling that somebody said, good old Stokes, because we'd another month in the UK. However, we then went to Scapa and got there on the 12th of June. And we did working up exercises in the UK, virtually, round and about Scapa. And then on the 17th of June, we sailed and went to Gibraltar on the 20th, by the 21st.
You said working up exercises. What does that entail on a ship?
It entails speed trials, trial of all guns, and various manoeuvres, and sort of making the boat see what the capability is. Of sort of, if you get a tyre coming across, you'd normally go into the wind. If you've got a tyre coming across, it then gives you the there's a marker on somewhere on the ship, like that, and it tells you how much you're.
So you check out roll with the ocean.
Roll, yes, and the pitching, and of course all the various instruments like radar and ASDIC, and whatever instruments are necessary for checking the speed and the accuracy of all the instruments.
And what about your own home role during the working up? Would there be anything other than, say, practice shell firing or something of that order? Would you be...
Well, of course, you then have to take into account seasickness. I mean, people inevitably are seasick, and Charlie Best in particular, he was just out. He just lay flat on the office floor and he stayed there till we got back in. And it was just useless, and the only way he could get over it was to go to sleep. And it did go to sleep. But, you know, not everybody's immune. I was, fortunately.
So you had no problem at all?
No problem at all. Even when we went to sea on trials, I had no problem.
So you were quite a good sailor, were you?
Yes. Mm. I think it helps if you're determined as well. I think that comes into it, you think. So and so, I'm not going to be seasick. And a lot of, I think there's a mind over matter, but because I managed to do it, I would think so. Right.
Is it the case with some people on board that even though they've been to sea a number of occasions, they will still be seasick?
Yes. Charlie Best was one of them. He knew, and he'd been on Russian convoys. And of course, it didn't help him in his job, because at the time he was going, this is praise to Charlie, really. The time he went on Russian convoys, he'd only sort of a nucleus of people to work for him. And of course, if you go out to sea and you're sick for 2 or 3 days, you've 2 or 3 days work behind before you set off. And then, of course, you've got the problem of Russian convoys. So this is one of the reasons why things were a bit dodgy when we first joined, with a lot of work to catch up on.
Did he have a problem when you were in sort of calmer waters, or was it purely while you were doing that kind of work?
That you always roll on a ship, no matter what. You don't experience calmer waters as such. It's just that if you get a bit of a roll, you get a bit of a roll. And it's very seldom you've got steadiness all the time. But there were times when the ship was rolling, I'd be sitting at my desk and the roll would take me back, and the only way you could do that was to put some dusters or cloths, wet them and put them under your seat to sort of stabilise it somewhat.
Did you have a problem with the roll of if you were at your desk, losing your writing implements and things that you were using at the time off the desk?
No, because you always either had it in your hand, but you get sort of this sort of feeling that... I know that looking back on these references I've made, one of the things that was a problem, of course, is writing letters in a hot office and dripping off your head. They were so hot, you know. So there were times when... We went to work out of the office in the port waste. And of course, if the ship was at sea, you got the wind.
And you'd sailed for Gibraltar?
Sailed for Gibraltar. When we got to Gibraltar, I had the first experience of what a kamikaze pilot was up to. There was an aircraft carrier in there. I can't remember the name of it, but there was a big hole right in the middle of the flight deck. Just a huge hole. And that's the first knowledge I had of kamikaze pilots.
Obviously, you knew you're going to the Far East. How did you feel about that at that time? Can you remember?
Well, we wondered how the hell we were going to invade Japan, because it was an isolated island, basically. All of them were down there. And, we just had to accept it. We were obviously concerned about it, whether we'd ever come back again, of course, because it was a bit dodgy. You know, it's, I'm not belittling the invasion to Europe, but I know the Americans sort of got into certain islands, but thinking of how we should do it, you know, I don't know who knew, but there we were. And you just took it for granted. And we didn't talk about it much, really, other than when I got on board, the thing was, the chief said, "You know where we're going, don't you?" I said, "Well, I can guess." He said, "Yes, the Pacific. We're going to invade Japan." And, you know, that was a joke, really.
What about what you did in the Mediterranean?
Again, you did working up exercises in Malta for some time, and we went ashore in Malta and were there for a matter of 4 or 5 days. I know we were there at weekends somewhat and went ashore.
What were things like ashore in Malta?
Well, quite good, really, although the place itself was in a terrible state, bombed and that sort of thing. But it was, in one respect. But the strange thing was that the buildings that were left, they withstood it. There was a huge church there, which, and of course, the very religious race of the Roman Catholicism, of course, is obviously there, and they had the knowledge of they spoke English with a Maltese accent, and every Saturday night there was a fight in the square between the Navy and the Maltese, but it was all in good fun. You could stand and watch it, or you could join in. I stood and watched it. You know, it was one of those things that happened, and we went round to had a look round the island. Went to church.
Because the churches are very decorative, aren't they, inside?
Very. Oh yes. It's one of those things that you wish you'd. But of course, there were no photographs at all available that you could take. It's just a memory that you take back, and you could buy some. There is one photograph I have of. Have been taken in Malta, and I think that was the first time we were in number sixes, white uniform, you see, and that was in Malta.
Can you explain the white uniform, what that consisted of?
Normal trousers, and then a tunic which was buttoned from round your below the waist right up, and then you had a sort of a tight collar around your neck, and of course you simply got a white cover for your standard cap and wore that over it.
So that's the Tropical Supply Branch uniform, is it?
They were called number sixes, but then when you got into really hot climates you had the shorts and the shirt and of course there you've got the white shoes. And there were shoes, you didn't have white boots.
How easy was it to keep everything so white?
Well, it was basically washing, you know, washing it and keeping it clean. I don't think I had anybody to wash them then, but I suppose that's the first time on. And of course, you weren't issued with them until you needed it, so they were in pristine condition because they came quite out of stock. And anything that's new seems to last longer until you wash it, and then it gets dirty quicker, doesn't it? This is June 1945.
How important was appearance when you went ashore?
Well, you were inspected, of course, when you went ashore. And on one occasion I had to go back. This was in, in dock that I got sent back to take a brush and brush some dandruff off or something of nature. And I went ashore again on the following boat. But it was a, yeah, I think it was a sub-lieutenant and midshipman or something. But the others just didn't bother, you know. But, I mean, obviously, you look smart. Going back to Plymouth, to Portsmouth Barracks, before you went ashore, there was a big mirror. And something about, are you fit to go ashore? Are you dressed fit to go ashore? And takes me back to an occasion. I was in Portsmouth Barracks waiting to go ashore, and the officer of the watch said to one chap, he said, "What you got in there?" Because it's something bulgy. He said, "It's a bottle, sir." I said, "Pull it out." He said, "What is it?" He said, "Cough mixture." "Give it to me," he said. "Yeah, it's cough mixture." We don't know to this day whether it was cough mixture or not, but it was very good. He didn't say anything.
With the ship working up in the Mediterranean, how did the crew gel together? Was it gelling together more and more each day?
I just don't remember any difference at all. The ship's company, by and large, you know, you just accepted each other for what you were, and there was no sort of really of getting to know people other than the ones you came in contact with immediately, or you had something in common with them, or you met them sort of for reasons. And because of the department I was in, we knew by name everybody that was on board, because there's a mess list, and the start filing order, and you know the names. You don't necessarily know them. I'll go on later and explain how I got to know Desmond Albrow, but it's a long way away, is that. So we started sailing for the Far East from Malta on the 24th of July, and we got to port side on the 27th. And from there, we sailed through the Suez Canal. That was a daylight job going, so that was that.
What did that feel like?
Quite odd. Quite straight. You didn't feel you were in a ship, because you couldn't see anything underneath. You were just going on, and the Arabs kept waving and that sort of thing, route signs a lot of the time. And we went through and sort of we're allowed to wander about the ship as if we were not sailing, if you know what I mean. I mean, there was no sort of place where you went to do your duty. We worked in the office, and most of the seamen were cleaning the place and brushing it down or something, little bits of job. But it wasn't like a full sea journey. And were able to sort of some people knew when they, I think halfway down there's a place, and I can't remember what it was called, sort of biblical Mount Sinai, something like that, that we were told about and looked out for it. But it was very interesting. And I think it was at Port Suez, there was a famous Egyptian grocer, not Harrods, famous Egyptian grocer called Jim Irish. And once we got, I think it was either port side or port Suez, they came on board. Haircuts, about 2 minutes. And that sort of thing. And the dirty books, that sort of thing, they sold, and photographs. And the chief buffer then went round and swore at them all and told them to get off the ship, or words to that effect. That was, you know, interesting. And then we got to, from Port Suez, we got to Aden 3 days later. That's 31st of July. And Aden was very hot. And there were boys there that sort of dive for money. You throw coins in, and these I've never seen anybody quite as black as they were. And they dive for money, and of course the lads threw it over. And we only stayed there sort of a few hours, as far as I recall, and then got to Colombo on the 6th of August.
Did you go ashore?
We went ashore in Colombo, and at Colombo I received 5 letters from Joyce and 3 from home. I wasn't married then, of course. We made our way to have a meal ashore, which consisted of 2 eggs, salad and potatoes, 2 bananas, fruit salad and tea. Then we looked around plenty of shops, and at the time we bought a bunch of bananas each, because we've never had bananas since 1930, whenever it was. So we wandered around Colombo eating bananas. However, a short time after that, we crossed the line. And even though there was a war on, we still had the arrival of King Neptune and the ceremony dealing with it, and the Marine Band played too. Next day, Neptune arrived with his daughters, police, and full retinue. The captain and commander had to go down on their knees to be knighted, etc., with the order of, "We must get there." I forgot what that meant, actually. A full description of ducking, etc., was given there, and during the next few days, the ship was full of information and what we used to call a buzz that the war was over. And at last, the news came through over the radio. We heard the voice of Mr. Attlee, but not at the same time as you did. We heard it at 7 a.m., the difference in time zone, of course, just after breakfast. And the same, when it was announced, you know, that the war was over, and all the business about the atom bomb, a huge cheer went up all over the ship. And then that was it, wasn't it? We were free to go around and do a show the flag.
A couple of things there. Could you tell me about the crossing of the line ceremony? What actually happens?
Well, what happens? The shipwrights on the ship build a tank, and it's sailmakers as well. It's out of canvas, thick canvas, and there's a ring supporting it at the top. It's that shape. How that's made, I don't know, whether it's kept on the ship or not. And it's what? I should think it's about 12 feet across, or diameter. And the canvas then goes down the side, and this is filled with seawater. And as I recall, King Neptune and his daughters and all the paraphernalia, the Gilbert and Sullivan lot, they all sort of sit around suitably dressed. Where they got the dresses from, I have no idea. Whether that's it, and of course the captain and the commander, they have to go on the knees and before King Neptune. And then everybody on the ship who has not previously crossed the line have to go, well, I say have to go. They make a thorough check of all messes, and you have to put your name down when you've been, and you get on, and you've got to be so, well, it doesn't matter whatever you've got on, but obviously it's tropical rig, so you've got a shirt on and your underpants and your shorts, not necessarily shoes, but you then have to sort of sit on this chair, and then they just tip it up. You go in the water, then you dunk 3 times in the water, then you got out, and then you get a certificate, which I've got, but I mean, you can see it if you wish, but it's there. I've got it in a folder, which I've kept, and that's it.
And you also said that you heard of the war finishing, so how did you feel, and How did everybody else on the ship feel at that stage?
Well, I suppose we were so, I mean, a great cheer went up quite spontaneously all over the ship that the atom bomb had dropped. And I'll come to that later. The atom bomb had dropped, and because of that, the war was over. We didn't think of the implications of the Japanese at that time because we hated the bastards, didn't we? As simple as that. But that was it, you know, everybody was sort of hugging each other.
Did everybody know what an atomic bomb was, though,
at that stage? That brings me to something else which I was going to mention, and I've made a note of the man's name, and his name was Mr. Holmes, and we had an intelligence officer called, I think, Jones, who had classes, I think, taken a certain number from each class. I can't remember whether we were had to go or whether it's voluntary. I think it was voluntary if we wanted to learn about it. And we heard about protons and neutrons and so on and so forth. Difficult to appreciate, but put as clearly as possible with somebody who I believe Lieutenant Jones had worked on the project in America. No?
He'd worked on it in England.
He'd worked on it in England, anyway. But it was very interesting, and he was able to put it over in such a manner as we were able to understand as much as we could understand about the atomic bomb. And at a later date, of course, we had the opportunity to see what damage it had done. I also remember a Mr. Holmes, who was known as the schoolmaster. I think I've got the name right. And I'd be interested to hear from Mr. Holmes, if he ever gets opportunity, to find out whether he ever developed that cine camera they had, which he took. I remember being on the deck with him going up to Shanghai, and whether he's ever got it or not, I don't know, but I'd love to know at some time if he has.
So where did you go from Colombo? Where were you heading to?
From Colombo, we went to we spent VJ Day in Fremantle, and the night we went up to Perth from Fremantle, Fremantle being the port, and I went to the cinema. And the first thing I did when we got in the cinema, when the lights went out, I lit a cigarette. And then about 20 usherettes came and said, "Put that cigarette out." Well, I hadn't been to a cinema that didn't allow smoking in those days, and I stopped a good number, 20 odd years ago, and I don't know why I ever did smoke, but I did. But there we are. We stayed at Fremantle for about 3 or 4 days, and then from Fremantle we went off to Sydney and arrived there on the 30th of May, and 30th of August. And then from there we sailed off to Manus in the Philippine area, and then on to Leyte in the Philippines, and we then went on from Leyte to Karum, which as far as I recall is in and then from going through those places we left Sydney, of course, and run up the Pacific, and eventually we went to the Yangtze Bar, which is just the entrance to Shanghai.
Had you had a chance to see how the American fleets at all as you were going up through the islands?
No, not to my knowledge. We saw various vessels, but, well, you know, they just pass and you don't know who they are or what they are and so on and so forth. But we arrived at Shanghai a couple of days ago. This was written on the 11th of October. And we flew a silk Union Jack and also a white ensign, both made of silk, which had been presented to the Belfast by the people of Belfast and had only flown on special occasions. And this, of course, was one of them, being the first British ship entering Shanghai subsequent to the Japanese invasion. We are also now a flagship, and as we near Shanghai, the Chinese, standing on both sides of the river, gave us a welcome and a rousing reception, waving and cheering. And as we passed the various ships, they all dipped their flags and sounded their hooters.